is Thursday, August 19th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The Taliban start discussing what their new government will look like.
The head of the council, as you call the president, we would call that Rais al-Wuzara, or the head of the council. And we will have ministers. All the ministers will be appointed by this council and by the head of the council.
Plus, South Africans commemorate the killing of 34 miners by police during a strike 9 years ago.
We cannot cheapen the lives of miners.
We'll have these stories and more next. Speaking to Reuters News on Wednesday, Wahidullah Hashimi, a senior Taliban official, says that the Afghan government may be formed by a ruling council now that the Taliban has taken over, while the Islamist militant movement's supreme leader, Haibatullah Akhundzada, would likely remain in charge.
The head of the council, as you call the president, we would call that Rais al-Wuzara, or the head of the council. And we will have ministers. All the ministers will be appointed by this council and by the head of the council. Amir al-Mu'mineen is our leader, religious leader, and also politics is part of the religion. So, but still, he wouldn't play the role of president. He would play a more prominent role. We will have a person, or maybe his deputy would play the role of president, or we will announce, as in the previous government of us, we had Rais al-Wuzara. So we will have the same in this government as well.
He went on to say that it would be an Islamic government under Sharia law and that there would be no democratic system. Taliban leaders also met with former Afghan President Hamid Karzai, who was joined by the former government's main peace envoy, Abdullah Abdullah. Pictures posted by the Associated Press, Anas Haqqani, a senior leader in a powerful Taliban faction, was seen sitting next to the former president in that meeting. The U.S. branded the Haqqani network a terrorist group in 2012, and its involvement in a future government could trigger international sanctions. Former Afghan President Ashraf Ghani posted a video to his Facebook page Wednesday. The posting marks his first appearance since leaving the country as the Taliban assumed control and confirmed that he was in the United Arab Emirates. Ghani thanked the Afghan security forces, asserting that they were not defeated by the Islamist militants, but by a failure of the peace process. Ghani said that he supported the negotiations between members of his former government and the Taliban, saying that the process was one that needed to be successful. VOA reports that the Taliban are continuing to consolidate power in Afghanistan amid reports of violence against protesters in the eastern part of the country a day after the Islamist group announced that the war was over and that there would be no retribution. Witnesses say Taliban insurgents fired into the air and beat people with batons in the city of Jalalabad, where a group of demonstrators tried to take down a Taliban flag and replace it with the Afghan national flag on Wednesday. At least three people were killed and many others were injured. The Taliban did not respond for a comment on the matter. Afghan women and girls who have won freedoms that they would not have normally dreamt of under the last Taliban rule that ended 20 years ago are desperate not to lose them now that the Islamist militant movement is back in power. Reuters reporter Libby Hogan continues our coverage.
A group of Afghan women holding signs and protesting for their rights on the streets of Kabul. Women and girls in Afghanistan are desperate not to lose their freedoms now that the Taliban are back in power. Afghan activist Pashtana Durrani runs an organization that provides access to learning materials for 7,000 girls, mostly in rural areas across Afghanistan.
As an Afghan woman, I wouldn't trust them because they don't have a very clear track record of being keeping up their promises or something like that. And the Taliban should give a statement out that all these girls should be going to all these public schools, and no foot soldiers are allowed to harass them or target them or stop them. And then they should continue the way they are studying, right? If they're okay with all that, we're good to go. Then I'm optimistic, but they have to walk the talk. Right now, they're not doing that.
In their first press conference in Kabul, the Taliban pledged to respect women's right to work and education. but only within the framework of Islamic law.
Women will be afforded all their rights.
The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, expressed cautious optimism about working with Taliban officials, citing their early expressions of support for girls' education. But many others remain skeptical. Several women were ordered to leave their jobs during the Taliban's rapid advance across the country, and activists say they want to see the Taliban held to account for any commitment. During their rule from 1996 to 2001, guided by Sharia religious law, girls were not allowed to go to school, women could not work, and had to wear burqas to go outside.
Libby Hogan from Reuters News. The U.S. military continues to focus its efforts in Afghanistan on securing Kabul's international airport and facilitating the evacuation of Americans and allies. U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin told reporters Wednesday at the Pentagon there have been no hostile interactions with the Taliban and that their lines of communication with the Taliban commanders remain open.
Now, we don't take this for granted, and I continue to be in daily contact with General McKenzie and commanders on the ground to make sure that they have what they need to keep it safe.
He added that since August 15th, the U.S. military has flown out thousands of people and that they plan to continue to increase those efforts. General Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was also at that briefing, and he addressed reporters about the rapid collapse of the Afghan military following the U.S. withdrawal.
The intelligence clearly indicated multiple scenarios were possible. One of those was an outright Taliban takeover following a rapid collapse of the Afghan security forces and the government. Another was a civil war, and a third was a negotiated settlement. However, the time frame of a rapid collapse, that was widely estimated and ranged from weeks to months and even years following our departure. There was nothing that I or anyone else saw that indicated a collapse of this army and this government in 11 days.
When reporters pressed them on reports coming from Afghanistan that people trying to get to the airport were being stopped at Taliban checkpoints, Secretary Austin responded.
Well, we're going to do everything we can to continue to try to deconflict and create passageways for them to get to the airfield.
General Milley added,
for the American citizens, passport holders, the Taliban and the State Department are working out a facilitation. I got it, but they're working out a facilitation measure. So those numbers are likely to grow. For the others, the State Department is still working through exactly getting the procedures for the evacuees to get to the airfield.
Both Secretary Austin and General Milley said that the situation in Afghanistan was personal for them, with Austin sending a message to the families of veterans and those that have made the ultimate sacrifice during America's longest war.
And the U.S. military stands as one to honor those we've lost.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. In an exclusive interview with ABC News' George Stephanopoulos, broadcast on Wednesday evening, U.S. President Joe Biden said he wasn't sure that there was a way to leave the country without causing chaos, but stood by his decision to pull out U.S. forces. The U.S.-led war in Afghanistan began with the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on the United States and the U.S. driving out the Taliban that gave al-Qaeda safe harbor. 20 years later, the war has ended with the Taliban back in power in Kabul. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain looks at the lasting legacy for America of its longest war, ending back where it started.
On September 11th, 2001, al-Qaeda terrorists hijacked four American jetliners, crashing two into the World Trade Center in New York City, one into the Pentagon, and one into a Pennsylvania field. A total of 2,997 people were killed. Then U.S. President George W. Bush was quick to respond.
I can hear you. I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people. And the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
Bush ordered the bombing of al-Qaeda training facilities in Afghanistan, and a combination of U.S. air power and Afghan tribal alliances ousted the Taliban regime within weeks. Kabul residents danced in the streets, and men shaved off their beards, which were then required by the Taliban. Bush decided to invade Iraq and to widen the mission in Afghanistan, seeking to rebuild the country in the model of an American-style democracy. U.S. troops and aid workers helped rebuild Afghanistan, focusing on empowering girls and women who were not allowed to attend school or work outside the home under Taliban rule. But the Taliban quickly regrouped and began their years of armed resistance, including suicide attacks on Afghan civilians. Some experts say the unclear U.S. goals from the start in Afghanistan may have been the original sin in America's 20-year involvement. Jonathan Schroden is with the CNA Research Organization.
President Bush at the time felt compelled to leave Afghanistan better than he found it. And while he certainly wouldn't call it nation building, was willing to engage in some degree of that in order to try and, again, make Afghanistan a better place than it was before. But his Secretary of Defense, Don Rumsfeld, absolutely wanted to just get the U.S. military out of Afghanistan as quickly as he possibly could. And that tension really had a lot of deleterious effects early on in the U.S. presence in Afghanistan that arguably the U.S. Mission there never recovered from.
In 2009, then-President Barack Obama surged troops and contractors into the country in his first term, pushing the U.S. presence to more than 100,000 before announcing a drawdown years later that left a force of about one-tenth of that size. Former President Barack Obama.
For many of you, this will be your last tour in Afghanistan.
Obama's successor, former President Donald Trump, vowed to bring U.S. troops home from forever wars and had his top officials sign a peace deal with the Taliban in February 2020 to withdraw U.S. troops in 14 months. But after Bush, Obama, and Trump presided over the war, it is current U.S. President Joe Biden who is ending U.S. involvement. Defending the chaotic U.S. departure this week, Biden said the U.S. accomplished its goals in Afghanistan many years ago when it pushed the Taliban from power and killed al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden in Pakistan. President Joe Biden.
Our mission in Afghanistan was never supposed to have been nation building. It was never supposed to be creating a unified, centralized democracy. Our only vital national interest in Afghanistan remains today what it has always been, preventing a terrorist attack on America's homeland.
But for Afghans, both at home and abroad, emotions are raw after the rapid Taliban takeover of the country and amid images of Americans and other foreigners fleeing Kabul. Nourak Nasimi is with the Afghanistan and Central Asian Association in London.
You have to understand that building a nation, building a democracy is not a matter of time for 20 years. This is a long-term, yes, a long-term solution, there is a long-term commitment should be made by the U.S. and the international community. Afghanistan just have the opportunity of the NATO intervention in 2001. But 20 years is not enough to build a better future for the people.
Professor Samar Ali is with Vanderbilt University.
I think that the past week and the past several days have been incredibly damaging. I think that the trust has eroded between us in very serious ways. And one of the things that we must immediately do is cut the red tape around accepting Afghan refugees.
The rapid collapse of the U.S. mission in Afghanistan is likely to force Washington to think long and hard about sending troops abroad in the future, says Ian Bremmer of the Eurasia Group.
The legacy of the past 20 years will be a United States that is much, much, much more reluctant to engage in military-led nation-building exercises anywhere around the world.
Other experts say they see a short-term blow to U.S. credibility after troops leave Afghanistan, but add it is too soon to know whether there will be lasting damage to critical U.S. alliances. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
The U.S. is defending its plan to offer COVID-19 booster shots amid sharp criticism from the World Health Organization. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani takes it from here.
WHO Emergencies Chief Michael Ryan says poor nations don't even have enough vaccine to give their people a first shot.
We're planning to hand out extra life jackets to people who already have life jackets while we're leaving other people to drown without a single life jacket.
Here in Washington,
I do not accept the idea that we have to choose between America and the world.
Surgeon General Vivek Murthy says there's a responsibility to both. White House officials say the U.S. has donated 115 million vaccine doses to 80 nations, more than all other countries combined. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Speaking in Geneva, WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus told reporters the people of Afghanistan are facing an enormous challenge during the pandemic.
We are extremely concerned by the large displacement of people and increasing cases of diarrhea, malnutrition, high blood pressure, probable cases of COVID-19 and reproductive health complications. There is an immediate need to ensure sustained humanitarian access and continuity of health services across the country, with a focus on ensuring women and girls have access to female health workers. We're particularly concerned about the health and well-being of women and girls.
Tedros called on the international community and all actors to prioritize their access to all health services and to safeguard their futures. Students in the United States are returning to class for a new school year just as the number of Delta variant COVID-19 cases increase around the country. Experts say children seem to be more vulnerable to this variant, raising questions about how to protect students, especially those who are too young to be vaccinated. Daria Degutz has that story.
Since the coronavirus pandemic hit the U.S., over 36 million Americans have been infected, about 4 million of them children, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. After a relatively calm few months, the Delta variant is causing new surge of cases just as children are returning to class for the new school year. Dr. William Raska is with the University of Vermont Medical Center.
Nobody under the age of 12 has been immunized. So by definition, there's a huge susceptible population.
The most difficult situation, experts say, can be seen in the South, where vaccination rates are low and the Delta variant is spreading especially fast. Also, a number of governors in states such as Florida, Texas, and Arizona have banned mask mandates, although some school districts reportedly are defying those orders.
If schools go into the school year without masking and stay unmasked from, say, September to December, they will infect most of the kids that attend school. It's that transmissible. It's much more transmissible than it was last year.
Dr. Danny Benjamin, a distinguished professor of pediatrics at Duke University, participated in three studies looking at the impact of face masks on the spread of COVID-19 in schools.
And we studied over a million children and adults this past spring with no distancing, three children to a bus seat, schools open full time for everyone. And again, the chance of a child infecting somebody else at school once, if they came to school with COVID, was 1% or less.
But those who oppose face mask mandates argue such orders violate their freedom and that wearing a face mask is a matter of personal choice and responsibility. Many others have expressed distrust of the government and its claims the vaccines are safe. Meanwhile, experts say getting more people vaccinated is key to controlling the virus.
If we vaccinate the community, then the schools are safe. And then when the schools open, obviously we should try to vaccinate all our children age 12 and older. They're still not well vaccinated.
With the fast spread of the Delta variant, the American Academy of Pediatrics has already encouraged healthcare regulators to approve the use of COVID vaccines for children aged 5 to 11 as soon as possible, and approval is not expected for a few more months. Daria Degutz for VOA News, Washington.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Commemoration events are being held in South Africa this week for 34 miners who were shot dead by police during a strike at a platinum mine near the town of Ritzenberg in 2012. The incidents become known as the Marikana Massacre and was the most lethal use of force by South African police since 1960. In 2015, a judge recommended that the police who opened fire on the miners, some who were armed with clubs, spears, and other weapons, be investigated. But no such probe has ever taken place. As Darren Taylor reports, relatives of those who lost their lives feel let down by South Africa's justice system.
In the build-up to the shootings, miners striking for better wages killed two police officers. At the time, Cyril Ramaphosa, now South Africa's president, was a non-executive director of the Lonmin Group, which owned the mine. As the strike grew increasingly violent, Ramaphosa called for concomitant action to be taken against miners. But the judge who led the inquiry exonerated him from any responsibility for the killings. The inquiry did, however, question the fitness for office of now-retired police commissioner Ria Piecha and the actions of then-police minister Nati Mtetwa. It also condemned the police for using excessive force. But no one has ever been charged for any criminal offense connected to the shootings.
9 years on, still no justice.
Musi Maimane was a senior member of the opposition Democratic Alliance when the Marikana massacre happened.
We cannot cheapen the lives of miners, all in the interest of extracting resources for the benefits of a few at the expense of the many.
He says the African National Congress, or ANC, government has covered up the truth about what happened at the mine.
I asked her that day, I said to her, Ria, who gave the order to send mortuaries and to send bullets to the people? She still could not answer. I still have not gotten answers.
He, like many other South Africans, believes that while police pulled the triggers, senior ANC politicians were pulling the strings behind the scenes.
That's why none of them have been arrested and none of them have been charged, whilst in fact the orders would have come from the top to ensure that live ammunition in a democratic government was used against the poor of this nation who were simply demanding not just a wage, but dignity.
The state has, however, paid some reparations to relatives of the slain miners. Solicitor General for the Department of Justice, Fedzisani Pandalani, says it settled 35 of 36 claims brought against it by families of the Marikana victims.
The quantum of the amount that has been paid to date is 69,083,000 rands.
But Pandalani says the group representing the families, the Socio-Economic Rights Institute, has made a further demand of general and constitutional damages.
We believe that we, as the state, we needed to approach this matter with some degree of humanity. We then said we are prepared as government to pay to all the claimants an additional 500,000 rand without prejudice, of course. That offer has been rejected. I think it must be placed on record that that offer has been rejected.
The Institute's demanding an additional 1.5 million rands for each of the miners' families. Pandalani says the state's hoping a compromise can be reached. Meanwhile, the relatives of the Marikana victims say they'll take the money because they need it, but they'd rather go to court to see punishment for those who shot their loved ones dead. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And finally, climate change is transforming the world's shorelines, even as we speak. Animals and plants that can't tolerate warmer water are fleeing to cooler areas. In part two of the series, Coast versus Climate, VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias takes a first-hand look at how nature is struggling to heal.
This is Goodwin Island in Virginia. You can see here down the coastline. That is slowly eroding. And then if you look off this way, there is the salt marsh that is slowly replacing the forests that were once there.
Scientist Tyler Messerschmidt explains that trees cannot live in the wet, salty ground from sea level rise and storm surges in the York River. Because of climate change caused by humans, the water is getting warmer and expanding. Where thriving trees once stood guard, he says we have ghost forests, and they make climate change even worse.
These forests are great stores of carbon that are there, and as those trees slowly die, that carbon is returned, some of it, to the natural system, including the atmosphere, which also leads to possibly more global warming through climate change.
Marshes like these help keep the base clean. They protect against the wrath of hurricanes. But they, too, are drowning. They have the capacity to migrate inland to protect themselves. But development along the coastlines is leaving them nowhere to go, says Michael Oppenheimer, a review editor for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
Bangladesh, parts of India, Thailand, a lot of Thailand, Myanmar, Vietnam, these have large stretches of marshland, which is in the tropics. Mangroves are a dominant species, and we're eroding away the base of those systems.
Scientist Deborah Steinberg tows nets to collect samples of other organisms that are relocating because of climate change.
Those, you can see them.
Yeah, so those are copepods, rice grain size crustaceans, and they're sort of a central part of the ocean food web.
In what's called the biological pump, they help sink carbon dioxide, the main global warming gas, to the depths of the ocean.
If we didn't have the biological pump, then the atmospheric carbon dioxide would be 50% higher than it is now. And if we have higher carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, that causes more of a greenhouse effect, and that's more warming.
The warming has changed where these marine drifters operate.
We have tropical and subtropical plankton that are expanding their range away from the equator, and then the subpolar and polar species, their ranges are contracting. A lot of the tropical, subtropical plankton are smaller, and so they're not as efficient at transporting the carbon.
Scientists around the world are monitoring these negative effects of climate change. They are also working hard to help nature heal itself. The species known as eelgrass also absorbs carbon. It was once abundant in the Chesapeake Bay, but it's dying back from high temperatures. Biologist Christopher Patrick and his team are hunting for answers.
Rather than just plant eelgrass, we're also planting another species. And that species is another native seagrass that's in the Chesapeake Bay called wigeon grass, and it can handle high temperatures.
The ultimate hope is that the two species will help each other survive and protect other creatures at the same time.
Juvenile fish and crabs, they have higher abundance. They have faster growth rates, and they survive better in the grass beds than outside of the grass beds. And so it's performing this really important service for the fisheries.
During the fall of 2021, wigeon grass seeds will be planted for the first time on a large-scale restoration project near Virginia Beach. It's a project that could be a model for ailing shorelines around the world. Veronica Valderas Iglesias for VOA News, Gloucester Point, Virginia.
And this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events. You can do so 24 hours a day by pointing your web browser on your phone, your tablet, your desktop computer, or any other electronic device to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.